It's Ruckus number 5.
To the Ruckus episode 5, soon to be not the ruckus but something new and exciting. In today's episode, we're going to cover a couple quick news articles. We're going to discuss our topic today, which is language, and then we're going to do a little bit about jet lag because we just purchased tickets to London and we need to learn about how to overcome jet lag. This is Rachel.
And this is Justin. You're listening to the Ruckus. First news article of the day. Sad news has struck nerddom everywhere. Rachel, are you familiar with a celebrity named Gary Gygax?
No, but Gygax does sound like a nerdy last name. Sounds kind of like Gigabyte.
Well, this is actually about as far away from the Gigabyte as you can possibly get. This is all about paper and pencils and 20-sided dice. That's right. One of the creators of the Dungeons & Dragons series of games has passed on to the great dungeon of the sky, the dungeon mastering of the heavens. He has moved on at the ripe old age of 69, so actually kind of young.
I have a question for you, Justin, about this news article.
Yes.
How long has Dungeons & Dragons been around? Because I know we played it when I was a kid, and I'm like 35, but hasn't it been around for like maybe 10 years before then or something like that?
Oh, he created Dungeons & Dragons in 1974. 1974 was when the first version of Dungeons & Dragons came out. Not completely similar to the version that people are playing today. And as a matter of fact, they just barely came out with the fourth edition of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, which includes online components and, computer-generated characters and stuff like that.
So he must have come out with that original one right about when he was in, like, his early 30s or something.
That is correct.
Okay. Yes. Well, I mean, at first it kind of blew my mind to think that somebody could be, you know, I'm like, God, am I that old that the guy who created this stuff is that old that he can die? But I guess it all kind of comes together and it makes sense.
That's right. He will be missed. And, you know, I tease and I kid, but I was a big fan of the game when I was growing up. And I would not be opposed to playing it now. And as a matter of fact, I read, not in this article, but in another article from Sci-Fi Wire, that he was still dungeon mastering and playing games and running games up until January of this year. So he
cool.
was still very active in the gaming community. And as a matter of fact, he was up until recently, people would see him at game conventions and things like that.
Well, he will be dearly missed. He was clearly an important man.
Yes. Well liked, too.
Well, Justin, have you heard that snow contains large amounts of bacteria?
I don't doubt it.
Well, you know, I don't doubt it either. It's kind of funny. This one's from the Associated Press. They just found out that snow contains incredibly huge amounts of a bacteria called Pseudomonas syringae.
They weren't measuring the yellow snow, because I hear that that's the most bacteria is right there.
Right. Well, you know, exactly. You know, you tell your kids, like, don't eat the yellow snow or don't eat the dirty snow because, you know, that's dirt, right?
Right.
But what they're saying is that air pollution also causes just regular white snow. If you just stuck your tongue out and snow fell onto your tongue, it would be full of this bacteria.
And you would die.
No, actually, it turns out this bacteria is relatively harmless. It's a bacteria that is everywhere. And, you know, if you send your kid out to the playground to play, they're probably coming into contact with more scary bacteria than they would if they were eating snow.
So you're telling me that I should or should not eat snow?
Well, I'm telling you that you shouldn't sit down to a meal of snow, but it's okay for it to land on your tongue or you can lick it off your glove.
Did you ever used to eat snow?
I've not been in any snow hardly ever in my life, so I haven't really had much of an opportunity to eat snow. I don't think I ever have.
That was one of my favorite pastimes in the winter would be sitting down with a fork and a knife and a plate and just covering it with snow. I'm kidding.
Lots they did in Ohio.
Yeah.
That me being in California, didn't get a lot of snow exposure.
No, we did eat snow, though. That was one of the things. You wouldn't make a meal of it. You would just be sitting, and it didn't taste especially good. It would just be, you know, you'd be in it. You'd be playing with snowballs. You'd be making forts, and you'd be like, huh, I'm going to eat a little bit of that. So,
I'd be curious to do it. I'm sure I would be. I might even still do it, even if there is this harmless bacteria in it. I mean, there's bacteria in everything, really.
Yeah. That's where the phrase, don't eat the yellow snow, came from, is because we knew that everybody would be eating the white snow. You gotta eat snow. It wasn't, don't eat snow, because, you know, you're going to eat the snow. Just don't eat the yellow snow.
Or the dirty snow.
Or the dirty snow. Or the snow that you find underneath the car.
Right.
But that is the best for making snowballs. It's the most painful snow, is the car snow. Rachel, I'm going to tell you a list of famous people. And you tell me, what do they have in common?
Okay. Have fun.
Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
Jimi Hendrix.
Okay.
Timothy Leary.
All right.
And Moses.
Well, here is my guess. Are you ready for my guess?
Yes.
My guess is that they're all dead people.
They are all dead people. You're right about that. So they do have that in common.
You stole my news story. They were all high on drugs.
They were all high on drugs. That is right. I would also venture to guess that they've all had religious experiences in their life. So according to this article, which I found on Breitbart.com.
It came from the Agence France Presse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. it. That's where they got it from. So this is the exact same article. And you can add in anything that any insight that you might have into this.
Okay.
Apparently, according to this article, Moses was on psychedelic drugs when he heard God deliver the Ten Commandments. This is according to researcher Benny Shannon, a professor of cognitive psychology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. As far as Moses on Mount Sinai is concerned, it was either a supernatural cosmic event, which I don't believe, or a legend, which I don't believe either, or finally, and this is very, very probable, an event that joined Moses and the people of Israel under the effect of narcotics, Shannon told Israeli Public Radio on Tuesday.
What do you think about that?
I think that narcotics would explain a lot of things that we find in the Bible.
I agree. In fact, I think that a lot of religions in the past and even presently use mind-altering drugs as part of their ritual processes. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if they were all high. And I think it's pretty awesome that they're finally saying that out loud.
Yeah. Well, you know, this guy might be saying this out loud, but there is so much stigma attached to the use of drugs and mind-altering substance in our culture here today that there are probably a whole lot of people here that will just instantly, that is not possible.
Well, when we change history, we change who we are now, and that's very freaky to people.
Right.
So that's what it would involve, you know, accepting that. So I imagine it won't be widely accepted, but it is nice that people are saying it out loud.
Yeah.
You know?
They'd really have to re-examine, like, how they feel about narcotics or how meaningful the Bible is to them.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Certainly. If they were going, based on the assumption that they're going to say, yes, this is accurate, Moses was doing drugs. So what does that mean about the Bible?
Oh, yeah.
Is that nonsense? Is a hallucination the same as a religious experience? Or maybe the Bible isn't entirely accurate? And a lot of it is just based on, like, I don't know, metaphor?
Or maybe we should all go get high and talk to God. and then write some new chapters to the Bible.
Well, that, my friend, is where we get the Book of Mormons.
Right. I would like to add something to that, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
It also says in the article that this guy believes that Moses was taking in a concoction based upon the bark of the acacia tree, and that's what created the psychotropic drug for him. And the acacia tree is also frequently mentioned in the Bible.
Yeah, that's very interesting to me. I would really love to have somebody who was a Christian come and let us know what their feelings were on this topic.
I kind of would too, but I would kind of be upset about it, because unless we found a really open-minded Christian who was at least willing to entertain on some level that it's possible, I think it would be kind of an annoying conversation. We wouldn't really get anywhere except hearing them be angry about it, you know?
So if you think, like, if you think back to some of the stories you know about the Bible and just kind of think about it, and you just imagine everybody was high and just be like, man, like, we were there. And the fish just kept coming. They never stopped. And there was wine, and we were all drinking, and it was like, dude, Jesus, you've created, like, endless fish, man.
He parted the Red Sea. Cut it right in twain.
Yeah.
All those people turned to pillars of salt.
Yeah, just looking around everywhere. Everyone was a pillar of salt. There were so many animals on that boat, dude. Like, he had, like, two of everything. Fucking everything.
So, Justin, would you like to introduce our topic?
Yes, today's topic is language. And we are going to tell you everything there is to possibly know about language within half an hour.
No, we're not.
Okay, we will skim the very, very tip of the surface.
Language and linguistics.
Language and linguistics. We just kind of picked a couple things that maybe we ran across when thinking about language, or things that we just kind of think are interesting in general. I imagine that Rachel and I, being lovers of language, will eventually discuss, you know, some other linguistic type things in the future. But as of right now, these are the kind of things that we've kind of decided were interesting enough, and things that we've either researched or were knowledgeable enough to kind of talk about.
Okay. What was high on your priority list that you want to talk about, Justin?
I was having a conversation with somebody that I work with about accents.
Yeah.
And the way that people speak, and whether or not we here in California have or speak with an accent.
Yeah.
In comparison with people in the rest of the United States.
Okay.
Okay. And my position is that we here in California have the least amount of accent when we're referring to the American version of English. Now, I'm not including, like, the European version, because they would say that we definitely have a very thick American accent.
Right.
But when we talk about the American version of English here in California and most of the northwestern states, we don't have a lot of accent. If you look at people like from Boston or from Louisiana or from all of these places, you know, where you've got a very distinct either like Cajun or Southern or, you know, Bostonian accent, that you can very much identify somebody geographically based on the sounds that they make.
Right.
I guess her belief is that every single time you make a sound, every time you speak, you have an accent. Like, you can't speak without making an accent. I don't think that that's entirely true. You know, I do believe that, although I kind of have a little bit of a Midwestern accent that comes out sometimes when I speak.
Right.
You know, I don't feel like I really have much of an accent. I don't think you have much of an accent. And I also think that if somebody in the room was from Boston or from Louisiana or from Kentucky and they spoke with that regional accent, I don't think that they'd be here saying, I do not have an accent, you know?
Okay. Well, I actually did a little bit of reading. There's a linguist by the name of Rosina Lippi Green, and she did an entire book about English and accents. And she says that U.S. standard English is an idea that everybody has in their mind about what it is, but nobody quite reaches it. So the idea of non-accent is merely an idea. She talks about people like, you know, famous newscasters, like name a famous newscaster.
Walter Cronkite.
Like Walter Cronkite. People assume that people like Walter Cronkite are speaking U.S. standard English or pretty close to it. I think that she kind of agrees with that a little bit, that it's close to it, but nobody really speaks U.S. standard English. There's, you know, there's written words, and then there's the actual English that you speak. She talks a little bit about what is accent and how do you define it. And she said there's two parts to it. There's how you speak, you know, for example, if you speak really quickly or how the words come out in terms of speed. That is an element of it. And of course, the other element of it is how do the consonants and vowels come together and how are they pronounced and how do they come out of your mouth? And so, you know, people from like Kentucky, they're going to pause at different parts of their speech than you and I would in California. And then, of course, their vowels are going to come out differently. And maybe even an entire word, like won't come out the same. Like, we might say drawer and they'll say drawer, you know.
Right.
All those things come together to make an accent. But she said that basically there is no such thing as, I mean, we'll call it an accent to identify the regional pronunciation, and that's what we use to identify it. But, you know, everybody's way of speaking a language is equally relevant for where they're at, and it does help to define who they are in terms of their regional boundaries, but there is no U.S. standard English, apparently.
Well, you know, the whole thing about being relevant and being correct,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's where a lot of her hang-up was in this conversation that I was having,
yeah,
was that for somebody to say that there is a version of English where there is no accent doesn't mean that there is a more correct version of English, or that other versions of English are somehow incorrect or not, you know, relevant. I think that saying that there's an idea of accentless speech is the same thing, like, you know, there is the idea of a square, and we can't create a square in the real world, you know, not a perfect one anyways, but we can all know what that square is. And like, when I say to you, make me a square, you've got the concept that lives in your mind and you know what that is. So if I say, these are the rules and this is the way we speak and this is the way that the words are meant to be pronounced,
right,
you've got something to shoot for. You know, you've got the correct way to say things.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. I mean, I could go into it with you about how everybody's going to have their own idea of what U.S. standard English is. And if there was a way to get it out there so that we could all see it, we'd all see that we all have a slightly different idea, because that's just how it is, because nobody's ever really heard it.
I don't think you have an accent.
I think I probably do, in terms of when we talk about what defines accent, you know, how the words come out of my mouth and then how I pronounce the vowels and the consonants and that sort of thing. I think that there is a definite regional
identification in my speech. I actually think you should go meet this woman and start talking to her, and she will write a new book, the sequel. It'll say, When I Met Rachel, or My First Book Was Completely Wrong.
She gives a really interesting example from her book, because the thing about accents and these regional differences is that people judge other people based upon their accent. So, for example, if we heard somebody with a thick southern drawl, unfortunately, we might assume this person is uneducated or unintelligent based upon how they speak. And those sorts of things get in the way of people born in those regions who want to get like a vice president corporate job. They actually literally go to people who teach them how to speak properly, or closer to what the ideal is to properly, in order for them to be able to advance in their careers. And there was a lawsuit in Hawaii. Apparently there was a man who spoke English and Hawaiian Creole, both of them. And he was a meteorologist, and he 20 years as a meteorologist, and he auditioned to be a weatherman, and he didn't get it. He didn't get the position because they said he couldn't speak properly, and he sued. And the judge upheld that he didn't deserve to have the job because he wasn't speaking properly. And it's a really interesting situation, because the man had the education and clearly knew what he was talking about. But in terms of their idea of how he should sound or how he should say, you know, he's basically reading a script, but he wasn't reading it according to how they felt he should. And so he didn't get the job.
Now, you know, I lived in Hawaii for a little while, and I don't mean this as like anything personal against that gentleman and his lawsuit or whatever, but when somebody speaks with that Hawaiian Creole affect to their voice,
yeah,
it is sometimes hard for somebody who's not used to hearing that to understand the words that they're saying.
Oh, I know. I had a terrible time when we were in Hawaii. I was pulling the kayak out of the river, and you were going to fetch the car. And one of the local kids kept saying something to me over and over again. And I had to say what to him. I got embarrassed because so many times I'm asking him to repeat to me what he had just said. And he would say exactly the same every time. And then it finally hit me. He was offering to help me pull the kayak out of the river. And by then I had the kayak out.
Yeah,
but,
right.
Yeah, I had no clue that's what he was saying.
Yeah, well, there are, you know, and that's the other thing, is there are a lot of people there that are very eager to help you. And And there are a lot of people there that speak with their pidgin, and they speak with, you know, a combination of like Hawaiian words and English words and things like that.
Right.
Which, you know, when you live there for a little while, you get to understand it, and you know what they're talking about, and you know the words after a while. But because Hawaii specifically has so many people, mainlanders, people move there to retire or whatever, or people come over there from the U.S., from the continental U.S., you know, to retire or to live there. And then people come from Japan, you know, because
yes.
Hawaii is actually halfway between Japan and continental U.S. So I don't think a lot of people realize that it's as close to Japan as it is to us.
Right.
And unfortunately, for that guy, that meteorologist, it really isn't enough to have the knowledge or the education or to know it in your mind. Because if you cannot communicate with an audience effectively, then how can you expect to be a performer in that medium?
It's definitely a really interesting civil rights suit, and I agree with your, I agree with you in terms of, you know, if the whole point of the medium he was auditioning for was to be able to reach a broad audience and get information to them, you know, if he was alienating a large percent or even a small percent, but a decent percent of that audience, then perhaps he wasn't effective in doing his job. But you touched upon, and in this conversation, we touched upon Creole and Pidgin. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit in our topic on language, was the difference between the two. And so, I don't know if you know this already or not, Justin, but a Pidgin is a language that comes from when two adult-speaking people from two different language cultures come together in a situation, say, for example, immigration or an area where a new area of trade, usually a port, place like that, where people come in on ships and business needs to be done. Neither one of them know the other language, but they'll pick up key words, the words for money, the words for the product, things like that. So they'll start speaking in what's called a pidgin. And it usually involves, you know, bringing on words from the other language, but it doesn't have any grammar to it. It doesn't have, you know, prepositions, verbs, things that would make a perfect sentence. And so it's not really a language in that aspect. It's just a way that they're kind of trying to get ideas across to each other, and they're speaking a pidgin. But when those people, when those adults stay living in that area and they have children, the children are exposed to the pidgin, and naturally humans will create grammar. They'll just make it happen. Even though a pidgin doesn't naturally have grammar, a child will want to create grammar out of it and will negotiate that with other children. And then the pidgin evolves into a Creole, which is a language. And then the Creole continues to evolve generation after generation. And there's Creoles all over the world.
So me living in Hawaii, when I lived there, at the end of the day, you know, you start to use some of the words.
Yeah.
So, like, I wouldn't sign out at work. I'd have to sign the sheet, and I'd have to write all pow, or pow, which means, you know, finished. So, for me to use those words, and to, like, you call everybody bra.
Right.
Like, no, to use those words, am I then participating in pidgin, or am I participating in Hawaiian Creole?
Well, if it follows the rules of grammar, then you are learning the Creole. It would only be a pidgin if you were coming into a situation where you spoke only English or even only Hawaiian Creole, because that is a language, and you're coming into contact with people who didn't know that language at all, and the two of you are negotiating similar concepts and words to communicate with one another. But there isn't enough knowledge of the other language for either one of you to fill it in with grammar that would make sense.
Right. Right. And, you know, just getting back to your story real quick, I would just like to say about that guy, if he was a meteorologist and he was a weatherman, that's the weather show that I would watch. Like, I actually really liked it because they have a lot of people who speak with the Hawaiian Creole on the radio and everything in Hawaii. And I always thought it was awesome. Like, I'd love to listen to it. And I did not understand all of it, but I understood it well enough to appreciate it. They used to have this show on KTUH, which is the local Hawaiian college radio station. And they had a guy on there that used to come on and just tell stories using, like, versions of English, pidgin, and Hawaiian Creole.
That's awesome. And, you know, I would imagine that it would be a more culturally rich experience to hear the weather that way, because Hawaii is a very unique area in terms of weather. I imagine we're talking about, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of Hawaiians having their culture and legends and myths and their experience of their unique weather wrapped around, you know, and for me to walk in there and start talking about the weather, there may be a lot lost in terms of the words that I'd use, whereas a native speaker may use words that I don't understand. But, you know, if I took the time to try to understand it, I realize there's rich history there in terms of the types of words that they choose and, you know, the levels of meaning involved in how they describe the weather. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What do you think is the fate of the Hawaiian language? Do you think that this will be an enduring language? Or do you think that it's one of the ones that will kind of, it's not going to make it in the long run?
I think that that has a lot to do with who's in power. And it has a lot to do with whether or not the people that speak the language think it's important enough to continue to speak it. And it's always a power thing, whether or not a language lives or dies. It has to do with what culture is in power, what language do they speak, and to what extent are they trying to assimilate other people into the culture, their mainstream, you know, more powerful culture. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on in Hawaii politically or dynamically in terms of language. I don't know if people are trying to keep Hawaiians from speaking Creole or not. But it seemed to be pretty predominant when I was there.
Well, you know, any language is dependent upon, you know, teaching it to your children. I don't think that there are a lot of people living in Hawaii that don't at least know English in addition to the Hawaiian language.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So I'm actually going to tell you now about some of the languages that are becoming extinct.
Oh, great.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
That's called a segue. I've read about languages going extinct in a couple of different articles. The numbers don't always exactly match up. What I've heard is that there's about somewhere between 6,500 and 7,000 languages. And they all kind of agree that more than half of them are going to die out by the end of the century, and some of them put it all the way up to like 90% of the languages.
My goodness.
Right. So, and a lot of this is really dependent on teaching the language to your children. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, there are some places where culturally it's not important to retain the language. I know that, you know, where I work, there are a lot of Latin American children.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on their either the culture of where they come from or even the culture of their family, their language to hold on to Spanish is either, you know, their cultural identity, and it's very important, or in a lot of cases, it's something to be ashamed of, and you should never speak Spanish, and you shouldn't even try to have an accent if you can help it. You know, there's a whole range of things where it's like some of these kids from their family don't want you to talk to them in Spanish. They don't want you to acknowledge that they even know Spanish.
Hmm.
And as a matter of fact, one of my coworkers, as part of our job, we have to write the kid's name on a plastic bag.
Yeah.
And she was writing this kid's name, and she wrote the little tilde over the end,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is, if you don't know, it's the little wavy thing that goes over the end. And it's a different letter, actually. It's an enye, mm-hmm. and it makes a different sound. And so she wrote that, and the kid looked at it, and he's like, why did you make my name Spanish? You know, she heard it when he said his name.
Right, and it was there.
And it was there, and apparently the kid was really upset that she wasn't writing it the American way, the English way.
Wow.
Unfortunately for a lot of those kids, they don't have anybody instilling that sense of pride into them for their language. Which I don't know if that's a completely fair statement, because most of our kids actually do take a lot of pride in knowing another language. But, you know, from time to time, we will get kids where it is not a source of pride, but a source of shame. I'm going to tell you, since we're talking about, there are some languages on this planet where there are like 15 people speaking it.
Or oh
there
might goodness.
Be one person who still has a knowledge of it or something. And so I thought it would be fun to tell you some words.
Okay.
In other languages. You know, counting is related to language. And even, you know, there's American Sign Language where we count on our fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right?
Yeah.
It's like that. Speakers of Kewa, this is a language from Western Melanesia, use body parts to count very high. The counting system starts with the little finger, goes across all 10 fingers, then goes up the arm, across the body, and down the other arm. This makes 24 between the eyes, 36 on the other elbow, and 47 on the other little finger.
Wow.
So their counting system actually goes from their pinky, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then up their arm, across their face, apparently, between the eyes, and then down, and then instead of going 1 to 10 on their fingers, they go 1 to 47, they take the scenic route. We go direct.
That's fantastic. And, you know, in terms of how we conceptualize counting, we like to group things in groups of 10, you know, 1, 10, 25, 100. I wonder if they group things in groups of 47.
That would be interesting find out. Yeah, yeah. There is a language called Ghana. There are 800 speakers. Plants and animals are split into three categories. What do you think those three categories would be? This is Southern Africa, and they speak Ghana.
Plants and animals are broken into three categories. Well, this is always the stuff that's really fucking fascinating in terms of language. Why don't you go ahead and just tell me, because I don't know. It's not coming for me right now.
Edible.
Mm-hmm.
The word literally is eat things, and that's... I'm not even going to try to say this word. It's KX apostrophe OOXO.
Cool.
Kiksuksu.
Cool.
I am going to try. Okay, so there's eat things, harmful bite things,
uh-huh,
and useless things.
Oh, I love it. I love that.
I would love to see the list of animals that fall into useless things.
There are some cultures in Africa that only have three colors, black, white, and red.
Really?
Are the only three words that they have to describe, or not even black, white, light, dark, and red. Some cultures only have as many as 10 colors, and that's it. I mean, you know, here in the English-speaking world, I mean, just take a look at cosmetics and lipstick colors, and, you know, there's millions, but yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Well, you know what's really interesting about that is that when we think about language, it's a whole ability to conceive of things, you know,
right.
For us to have all of those colors, it gives me a whole wealth of ways to conceive of different colors that maybe, you know, if I tried to explain to somebody in their native language where they didn't have all those, you know, they wouldn't be able to even conceptualize the same thing that I was talking about.
Right.
And that's why they say, you know, when you're a baby, if you're able to learn more than one language, you have the ability to do well in other areas. Like they say, you know, Japanese-speaking babies are good at visual spatial puzzles. You know, Spanish-speaking babies might be good at another kind of thing. You know, so... And when you see adults who speak Spanish, mm-hmm, compared to English... And you look at the television shows that they watch or their comedians, the sense of humor is totally different.
Oh, yeah.
The way they are, the way they package things, everything is so different. And to me, I think that all comes from, like, language. The language, the part of the culture that you're a part of is, like, yeah, the culture is part of it. But the fact that you're speaking a different language means there's totally different pathways in your brain that are open. And so you have a different sense of ideas in your head.
That's, yeah, linguists call that the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, and that is that language is reality, and it's the construction of reality, and if you, it's totally, I mean, you know, we're talking about different worlds here, and if you grew up speaking a certain language, you're going to look at the world in a different way than if you, you know, grew up learned. And I mean, literally, as you learn the language, you're grooving pathways in your brain to certain ways of thinking, creating little pathways, and your roadmap in Japan of your brain is going to look different than the roadmap, you know, somebody born in the United States.
Right. Well, they also say that if you learn to speak three languages by the time you're six,
mm-hmm,
you will retain the ability to rapidly speak languages or rapidly learn languages for the remainder of your life.
I believe that.
So, yeah. And based on what I read, it doesn't matter what three languages you learn. If you just need to learn three of them. So that's pretty cool. Anybody who has a child or is thinking about raising a child, do your kid a humongous favor. If you want them to excel in life, grab a couple of language CDs, pick two languages, hand them, you know, well, maybe you should play them for them, you know, depending on how little they are. But, you know, play them some language CDs, man. Like, My father is completely fluent in Spanish, and to this day, I struggle with it. It would have been so easy if he would have just taken the time to try to teach me, you know? But now, as an adult, I'm struggling with trying to learn this language.
Yeah.
I've got another word for you.
Okay.
This comes from Oklahoma in the Southwest. The Lenape language, which actually is an extinct language, they have a word, and they just found an albino buffalo.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And they named him this. And it's called Quetamalsi. And that literally translates to, now you know how it feels.
Mm.
That word means now you know how it feels. And this is what they call albino buffalo.
This is a Native American language?
Yes, it is.
So the white buffalo are very sacred to those people. It's like the manifestation of God to them.
Yeah. And I guess if we really ruminate on what that means, with knowing that it means now you know how it feels.
It's that's the sound of my mind blowing just a little bit. I've spent some time with that.
Yeah. The Navajo language, 178,000 speakers. The Navajo language has a word. Dinisbas means, I'm in the process of driving a vehicle into something and getting it stuck.
That's the thing about Native American languages is that, we have words like car and that's it. Their language is made up of segments of words, little tiny bits and pieces that can be interchangeable. So they can say a word like really fast, small blue car. And, you know, for us, it sounds retarded because we're using English to say it. But to them, it'll be like, segment, 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 segment. Like, ha, te, tra, pa, 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 you know? And that sounds like one word to us. And it sounds like one word to them because each segment has meaning. And so it's pretty cool how flexible their language is that way based upon the fact that it's all these little segments that come together.
When I was living in Hawaii, I was living there with my girlfriend at the time. And she would volunteer at the Hawaiian Zoo.
Yeah.
And the Honolulu Zoo. And, so part of the job was like these Japanese tourists would come through and, you know, they'd have somebody show them all the animals and they would tell them the name of the animal in English.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the word for hippo is like in Japanese, it's some one syllable word. It's this little tiny one syllable word.
Uh-huh.
And so they would get there and they'd say, and this is hippopotamus. And the Japanese people would laugh and they would try to say it and they would struggle with it. And that was like the whole rest of the tour without fail. Every time a group of Japanese people came through, it was just from that point forward, them trying to say the word hippopotamus.
That's hysterical. That's really cute.
Yeah.
Well, the last piece that I wanted to talk about on this topic, and we've already touched upon it a little bit, is the theory of how we acquire language as children, and the theory is called the Soundhouse Theory. And Justin, you touched upon a little bit when you said that if a child learns three languages by the age of six, they're probably going to be much better prepared to learn languages for the rest of their lives. And that's how that fits. This theory fits in with that very well, because basically what it says is that where our brains are wired, they're created specifically for language and for the acquisition of language. No other brain, no other animal's brain can do that. And right from the point that we're born, especially at the very, very young age, when we're starting to learn language and we're listening for language and starting to form words, every language that's available to humans has only a limited amount of sounds and vowels that can be made. There's a huge variety of them, like the clicking sounds in Africa, and very subtle intonations in vowels, for example, in Mandarin Chinese, is very subtle intonations in vowels that we can't even hear. But when you're a small child, you can hear those really subtle differences. You can pick all of them up, every single one. But what happens is that if you're only exposed to one language as you start to acquire it, your brain kind of naturally starts to prune itself. And the sounds that you hear from the people around you over and over and over again are the sounds that you start to really identify with and pick up and you start to pronounce. And your capacity to hear all those other subtleties starts to fade away and eventually goes away completely. so that the bricks that you have to build your sound house are the bricks of your culture and the bricks that you were exposed to as a small child. And when you go to learn Mandarin Chinese as an adult, you're not even going to recognize, you don't even know you're hearing the bricks that build their houses. And that's why people from Japan, you know, they can't really say an L because they don't hear it.
Before I started working where I'm working, I never had ever met a Cambodian person that I know of. So I recently started working, within the last 3 years, started working with a lot of Cambodian people. And so, you know, they speak Khmer all the time.
Right.
And I've heard a lot of their words, and I've tried to learn a few.
Yeah.
And the word for uncle is bu, right? And as far as I know, anyways... And they say it all the time, you know, when you go, it's a sign of respect to call somebody uncle. So like if you're an older person, if you're in a restaurant and they're ordering, like we go to Cambodian restaurants and they say, boo, can I have blah, blah, blah. So I'm trying to say this word.
Yeah.
And all I know is that half the time when I say it, they laugh and they tell me, you are so far away from the word. You are so clearly wrong. You're saying it incorrectly. And the other half of the time, they're like, there, you just said it. Every time I say it, I go, boo, 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 boo. And they're like, that one was right. The one before was wrong. You know? And it's like, I think the secret is if I think of the letter P in my mind, I could say it the way that pleases them. But I can't do anything to actually say it and actually hear it, to hear a difference. So, yeah, that's I totally, without having that experience, it's hard to say, like, you know, like what you're talking about with the sound house thing. But having the experience on the other side where it's like you're trying to say a word in a language with native speakers that the way you're saying it is so far away from the way it's meant to be said. And it sounds identical. Like, for me to say it and for them to say it, I cannot hear the difference at all.
It's mind-boggling. And, you know, with learning Spanish, it's a little bit like that, too. Let me see if I can think of a good example. I think the letter T in Spanish isn't quite so T. Maybe that's it. I don't know. There's one of them where it sounds a little... You put your tongue in a different place in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe instead of, like, trabajo, it's trabajo or...
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of it, but, you know... It's a little bit less, I don't know. I can't think. You know what I mean? Think of a word that's like that.
No, I know what you mean, like trabajo. Trabajo. It's like a littler sound.
Right, than, and where you put your tongue on the palate of your mouth when you say it is trabajo. Different.
Yeah, you reach back further with your tongue to the roof of your mouth.
And so those things are very subtle and... You know, unless you're really thinking about what you're doing with your mouth when you're learning this language, like probably when you say, was it bo or boo?
Boo.
Boo. So boo. The O sound, you're doing something very specific with your tongue and you're pushing air through your mouth a certain way. And I'll bet you there's a slightly different position of the tongue that they do that's the same every time, but you can't hear it.
I think it's all in the lips, actually.
It might be, yeah.
I'll try to say it the way that I think is actually the correct way to
do it. Okay.
I'll try to say it the way that I think is actually the correct way to say it. Boo. Boo. Wait. Boo. Boo. Oh, and you know what? Just real quick. One of the things that I love to ask people when they speak another language is the words for the sounds that animals make. And the sounds that ghosts make.
Oh, yes. The ghost sounds. Yes.
It's because in English, we say boo. Right? Because that's a ghost comes out and he says, boo, I'm a ghost. Ah.
Boo.
Right. Exactly. And in Tagalog, the ghost says, bulaga.
There's a boo in there.
And yeah, and then in Khmer, he says, va-uh. And then, you know, and there's all kinds of fun things for animals, too. I always thought it would be cool to have, like, a children's book. About like a character who goes like around the world to different farms and you get to hear the words that like the rooster makes in every country because it's different. In Spanish, he doesn't say cock-a-doodle-doo. He says kikidiki.
Yes.
So, yeah, I love that stuff. Like I love the fact that we have a different... We don't think of the fact that the sound that an animal makes is a word, you know?
Yeah, that's true, that the way that it's expressed is different, and it is a series of, yeah, of little words that come together that... And being that we're on a world travel adventure, we get exposed to all kinds of new ideas like that. And one of the new places that we'll be traveling, we're very excited about. We just purchased tickets to London for my birthday.
Yes, we did. I'll tell you, before we get into talking about what we're going to say about London, I'll tell you, because we are talking about language, so the couple of words that I really love that, you know, British English speakers say.
Yes.
That's different from what we say. Aluminium.
Yes.
For aluminum. And centrifugal for centrifugal.
I imagine we're going to come back with a lot more. That's going to be really awesome. I can't wait.
Yeah. That's going to be a blast. So the one thing that we decided, you know, I'm sure we will talk about our London trip way, way more as it gets closer. We're leaving at the end of April. A couple of the things that we decided would be a cool thing to talk about would be tips for long flights, for dealing with jet lag, and for just making a 15-hour flight bearable.
Yes, and from my understanding, as I've begun to research all of this, is that apparently a 15-hour flight from east to west is a lot easier for the human body to adjust to than a 15-hour flight from west to east.
We're going west to east.
We are indeed going west to east, so we're going to have the hardcore experience.
I know a lot of people suffer from jet lag. I don't think I'm going to be one of those people. I think that I'll be able to adjust okay.
Well, my understanding on reading upon jet lag is that it's psychological to some extent. So to some extent, I think that mindset and attitude will have a lot to do with how well we'll both adjust to it. But it's also hormonal. There are circadian rhythms that our bodies are used to in terms of when the daylight is supposed to happen and when the nighttime is supposed to happen. And actually, when we're asleep, our bodies secrete a hormone that tells us we're sleeping. And so you start to mess with that. You start to mess with our hormone levels. And that's completely physiological. And that's something that's a little bit harder for us to psychologically control.
That's very interesting that you bring that up. One of the tips that I read was as soon as you get on the ground to try to expose yourself to bright daylight without sunglasses for at least 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't say why that's a good tip, but I imagine that it has a lot to do with what's going on physiologically.
Yes, your body, you have to tell your body it's daytime,
mm-hmm.
Even though your body wants to think that it's nighttime.
Isn't that crazy?
It is. Like, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Like you and your body aren't like in agreement all the time. And, like, you know, like you have to trick your body into like get on board with the this is what we want to do, body. Let's come on.
Well, you got to keep in mind, too, that human beings have been on this planet for a couple million years. But it's only been in the past, 130 years max that we've been able to fly over time zones and travel that rapidly from one part of the planet to the next. So we have not really physiologically adapted to, you know, we're talking about millions of years of adapting to sleeping rhythms and day and night happening in certain ways, and only maybe 100 years of rapidly changing from one environment to the next like that. And we have not adapted to that yet.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
We kind of jack ourselves a little bit, you know?
You know, I already put out the word to some of my coworkers that if they have a Nintendo DS for me to borrow for the plane trip, that I would buy them Super Mario Kart. That's how I'm planning on dealing with a large portion of time on the airplane, is by playing video games.
That's going to help with the boredom part. One of the things that I read is to... switch to local time. So the minute we get on the plane, we should adjust our watches to London time, and that will prepare ourselves psychologically for that. So we'll be a little bit ahead of schedule in terms of when we get there, in terms of adapting to what time it is. We've already kind of psychologically begun to think that way.
Yeah, I have the same tip on here. They also say to try to maximize your rest time by going to sleep immediately when you get onto the plane. are during takeoff. Try to get all your resting done at the first half of the flight rather than at the latter half of the flight. Try to get into a place where you can rest at the beginning. However, they do not recommend that you use sleeping pills of any kind. And as a matter of fact, they blame 18% of long-haul deaths on blood clots to the lungs, which sleeping pills help to induce. So sleeping pills are not a good thing to take. I would say they're not a good thing to take in general anyway.
They jack you up so bad. I hate sleeping pills. Yeah. Oh, the nightmares. It's terrible. Yeah. I've got to avoid alcohol, caffeinated drinks, and big heavy meals in flight. If you're traveling at night, eat a high protein breakfast and lunch to keep your energy up during the day, and have a high carbohydrate meal for dinner. So kind of change how you eat according to a local time schedule of where you're going to. And then, of course, alcohol and things that dehydrate you are really bad for you. So having a lot of water will help you, just because apparently the environment of being on a plane is like, It sucks all the moisture out of your body, and they're pumping air back in, and like, it's really a terrible environment. And so water really helps you with that. I'm going to personally take a lot of, there's like these little vitamin C packets that you can do. I'm going to take a whole hell of a lot of those.
Well, that's a good idea.
Emergency.
Well, these are all great tips, and we will put links. We will post links to these tips and to others on our website, which is www.theruckus.wordpress.com.
Including links to things about language.
Including links to things about language and some of the news stories that we talked about today. If you like the show, go tell somebody that you love to listen to the show. And if you hate the show, tell somebody that you don't like to listen to the show. And we'll put that all up on there. Thanks again to Outside Residential. You can check out his music at www.myspace.com/Outside Residential.
And that's our show for today, folks. Now go start a ruckus.
Go start a ruckus. Bulaga!